Welcome back to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Tyler Pratt. Eating Disorders Awareness Week is February 25th through March 3rd. Today, we're going to hear the story of Hannah Allen, a Cal Poly senior who recently shared her story with the San Luis Obispo Tribune in an effort to inform as many students as possible about an often hidden illness that could affect around 1,200 Cal Poly students. Joining Hannah is the author of the Tribune story, Monica Vaughn, and Libby Parker, an eating disorder registered dietitian. Hannah kicked off the conversation.
So I'm from the Bay Area, Silicon Valley, Sunnyvale, California, and I came to Cal Poly San Luis Obispo mainly for the running team and for the biology major. The science department here was amazing, and my parents and I were super jazzed about it. My main reason for coming here really was the team. I was recruited as a walk-on with potential to be on the traveling team for that incoming fall quarter, and kind of throughout my first and second year, I was doing pretty well with school and everything. It was a good experience. I loved the school. I loved my teammates, and I really wanted to do anything that I could to get on the traveling team, as I'm sure a lot of freshmen that year did. And things kind of declined a little bit for me when I was focused on losing weight. And for that fall quarter, it was really tough because I wanted to do anything I could to be on the traveling competitive team that was going to compete that year. So when I quit in spring of my freshman year, that was when the eating disorder really started.
Well, how did this eating disorder present itself in your life at this time in college?
Yeah, so my freshman year was mainly, it was losing weight. So I kind of started off more anorexic because one of the coaches had suggested that to get faster, I could lose weight. And at that time, it was a lot of weight that she had asked me. She had said, oh, yeah, this is healthy. You could get to this point. And I kind of took that as a motivation. Oh, well, if I lose 20, 25 pounds, that'll get me to my goal weight. And if I'm lighter, I'm faster for running, right? So it made sense in my head. And I started cutting back more on what I ate. And people started telling me, wow, you look so good. You look skinny. You look really lean. I'm liking this. And then I was running faster because I was in my head. I was like, oh, well, I have less fat on my legs, so I'm running faster. It's great. So it definitely was more anorexic in the beginning. And once I quit the team, I had quit more because of parent pressure from school. You know, they were a little concerned that my grades were dropping because I wasn't putting as much time or energy into other things. I was really focused only on my running, and they thought that was super unhealthy, which it was. I didn't realize it at the time, but quitting was a huge deal for me because those were my group of friends, my only group of friends really, and it was really hard to leave and all of a sudden just have a bunch of extra time where I wasn't running. And, you know, even if I was, I compared myself all the time to what other girls were eating, and that's when it became more bulimic and the purging kind of started.
Oh, wow. I want to just go back for a second. You had a coach tell you to lose 20 to 25 pounds?
She said I could get there in a healthy way. We were looking at the BMI chart. You know, I just asked her, I was like, what can I do to get on the traveling team? I want to get faster. And, you know, she had recommended starting to watch my diet. And we had a lot of meetings about diet and losing weight. And I kind of thought in my head that it was a doable goal just because I really trusted her, you know, and I think it's also that point where, you know, I was an impressionable freshman. I think a lot of girls are, and they just want to do anything they can to be the fastest. And, you know, it was a BMI chart, so it seemed pretty scientific.
Libby, this feels like a great time to go ahead and jump in here. Is this a story that you hear from incoming freshmen?
Oh, yeah. And not specific to the athletes. I mean, I see probably more runners than anything else, like if you had to, you know, put them into categories. But freshmen in general, or, you know, transitions into college, the transition from high school into college is just such a big time for students to develop eating disorders. Or if they had one previously, it's a good time for it to come up again. Because when we're under stress and transition and scared, even though it's an exciting time for most people, that requires a coping mechanism to come back up. So whether they're actually trying to lose weight or they're just really stressed out, this eating disorders are a coping mechanism. So they're leaning on that in that time of transition.
Where does your role fall into all of this for students coming in and possibly struggling with this?
As a registered dietitian, my job is really around the dietary component of it. So I look at all the, you know, tons of research out there on food and diets and how it, you know, works in the human body. And my, you know, the main job of a dietitian is kind of disseminating that information for the masses, because everyone has an opinion on what to eat. I mean, we hear every day people talking on the internet like, oh, I did this diet and I lost 20 pounds and I did this. And, you know, like, and there's not a lot of scientific evidence behind a lot of these things. And like even BMI that you're mentioning there, and Hannah was mentioning, it's not a really great indicator of health. Those benchmarks that the BMI is, which is body mass index, which is weight for height, was something that was developed a long time ago in young, healthy white males. It's not, you know, the end-all be-all for all populations. Like if you're a different race, if you're female, it doesn't necessarily correlate really well. And it doesn't tell us anything about body composition, such as, you know, muscle mass versus fat mass and things like that.
Hannah, did you think that you could reach out to a dietitian at any of this point? Did you reach out to anybody? Did you feel like those resources were there?
You know, I didn't think to do that at all. I didn't think it was a problem with what that coach was telling me, and because she was the coach and I trusted her and she had been my main kind of go-to for the recruiting process. And I loved her. I respected her. And, you know, I had a good relationship with her. So I didn't really think that there was a need to reach out to a dietitian and talk about it, because we were already spending a lot of time doing that. Yeah.
And then things quickly started spiraling for you?
Yeah. I would say that that was when things really started going downhill, kind of after that fall quarter. And it we talk about eating disorders as very dynamic things. They're not normally one condition and only that condition. They can also fluctuate from, you know, so in my case, it was I exhibited more anorexic behaviors, and then it kind of transitioned into bulimia. And a lot of other people kind of go through binging cycles, you know. So there's a lot that went on, and I would say that was just the start of it.
How long would you say that this, the worst of it, lasted for?
I would say the worst of it lasted I would say for 3 months. 3 months I was purging pretty often every day, and it was, you know, after most meals.
Were there any medical complications?
Absolutely. There were. I started developing acid reflux, and I thought at first, because my dad had that, it was, oh, it wasn't an issue. This is normal, part of my family's congenital history. Maybe it's not that big of an issue. That didn't really call attention to it. But I would get pretty uncomfortable after every meal and feel like my throat was constricting. I had There was a time during my fall quarter of my sophomore year that my mouth was starting to get really sore, and I couldn't keep food down.
This might be a great time to turn back to you, Libby, that eating disorders like anorexia and bulimia take a real toll on the body.
Absolutely. We see, whether you're in the denial phase or not, which a lot of people start in because they think they're starting a healthy lifestyle or something, which is usually the precursor to an eating disorder, medical complications can really develop without showing a lot of outward signs. So Hannah's acid reflux, obviously she felt that. A lot of people aren't realizing what the damage they're actually doing to their organs and their body on the inside, because if they were to get blood work done, their labs are going to look perfect until it's really late in the game. So it's very hard to detect, especially if someone is still at a normal body weight, which most eating disorders are not the emaciated, anorexic-looking person that we stereotype them as. Most people with eating disorders walking around are in a perfectly normal-sized body, or maybe even in a larger body. So it's really hard to detect if someone is not proactively saying, I need help.
So it sounds like your parents stepped in.
My dad noticed that something was off. We had a moment after my sister's birthday where he actually saw me purge a little bit in the sink. And he stepped in and said, hey, this isn't normal. That doesn't look like acid reflux. This is something else. And you're not telling us everything. And I said, no, I've been telling you everything. This is this is normal for me to get pain after I eat, Dad. And he and my mom flipped out. So as I would expect them to, I guess. It was only a week or two before I went back to school. So they were pretty scared at that point, and they made me go into the Cal Poly Counseling Center. And they had me schedule an appointment with the therapist. They watched me schedule it, so they knew that I wasn't going to lie. And I saw a therapist there. And then the Cal Poly Counseling Center had also recommended I see a dietitian, and that person happened to be Libby. So,
and tell me a little bit about this portion of your journey, about coming to terms with all this and talking to experts.
I was still pretty much in denial about it. I'm sure as a lot of people are, because I was only going to therapy because my parents made me go. They said they would pull me out of school if I didn't go. So that
this
was kind
actually
of
actually really common. A lot of people go because my parents made me.
Yeah. Yeah. So they don't, you know, I didn't really think that I had a problem. I knew that they were telling me I had abnormal eating behaviors, but it didn't click in my brain that it was something bad for me because I was still running really well. I was on the distance club. You know, I had just joined a competitive running team again, and I was still running fast, so it was great for me. So I think talking to Libby, she explains the science of it to you, and okay, this is what you do to your body when you don't feed it enough carbohydrates or lipids or glucose. And I remember arguing with her. I would just argue with her and say, you know, I don't, well, this is the way that I think about this, or this is a lie I believe about Ed. And she'd say, no, I'm going to refute that with science. And that was really helpful to me, I think, to kind of start processing what could be wrong about the way I was thinking regarding the eating disorder. It was, I wouldn't say I really made progress until about a year later. I didn't actually come to terms with, okay, I need help, until about a year later.
And you touched on something. You named your eating disorder.
I did name it. Yes, it's actually a pretty common thing, I think, in therapy for eating disorders to name it. And the most common name for it is Ed. And it kind of helps to personify the eating disorder in my experience. For me, it allowed me to better separate me from my eating disorder. It allowed me to feel more liberated from it. If I think of it as a separate entity, it's not who I am. It's just something that I'm struggling with. And at that point,
I think the thing to remember with eating disorders, and it took until I really learned this part of the science behind it to be okay with people being in denial for a while, is that when people have not been fueling their body properly, usually under eating or not getting the right mix of nutrients, so some sort of malnourishment, the brain actually starts to shrink and causes cognitive distortions. So they're not thinking clearly when they're in this malnourished state, and that makes it very hard for them to think they have a problem. The longer they are malnourished, so the people who are very deep in like anorexia nervosa, they are going to be fighting this tooth and nail because they don't think they have a problem. They can logic their way into anything. So it's really slowing down, stepping back, showing them the science, coming alongside them, and explaining that you may feel okay right now, but if you keep doing what you're doing, this is the long-term consequences of it.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. In case you're just joining us, I'm Tyler Pratt, and I'm speaking with Hannah Allen, a Cal Poly senior who developed bulimia as a student athlete her freshman year. This week is Eating Disorders Awareness Week. Hannah is joined by her dietitian, Libby Parker, and Monica Vaughn, who has penned Hannah's story in the San Luis Obispo Tribune. Monica takes the lead on this portion of our conversation.
What I found striking as after I first spoke with Hannah, she's unique in that she understands scientifically how the eating disorder is affecting her physiologically and psychologically, but she's not unique in that she struggled in this problem in secret and in shame. I found that there's a Healthy Mind study out of the University of Michigan that does random surveys for mental health issues on 60 college campuses around the country. And last year, they found that 10% of students surveyed showed signs of likely struggling with an eating disorder. That's 10% likely 10% of college students. And Cal Poly, the first time they participated in that survey in 2016, had 6% of students likely suffering with an eating disorder. And based on the college campus population, that's 1,200 students, and it's likely higher than 6%. It's probably between 6 and 10%. And on Cal Poly, you know, it is a campus that's really focused on athleticism, on fitness, and on health. And I'm really surprised and shocked in the when I started investigating the issue at how little we're talking about eating disorders as a serious illness and that needs to be addressed. Cal Poly doesn't track how many students seek help for eating disorders, let alone how many might have them or have been found to have had them. And even within our community-wide, we know that, you know, anybody in the population can be affected by an eating disorder. The most common is binge eating disorder, but there's also anorexia and bulimia. And that ranges from children all the way to, you know, 90-year-old adults and more. And I was really surprised as I was working on this story, I happened to get the San Luis Obispo County, they recently released a 75-page county health assessment. And it did discuss healthy eating within the context of obesity, but there was nothing in the entire document that described eating disorders or talked about them as a community issue.
That's really surprising considering the efforts that this county goes to work towards mental health.
Right.
You think that would be covered in there. Have you spoke with anybody at the county to talk about increasing that awareness or plans moving forward?
I haven't talked with anybody at the county. I have talked with Cal Poly spokespeople, and apparently, you know, as I learned from Hannah, it sounds, and from Libby, it sounds like athletes have a really high risk of eating disorders. A well-respected study found that in a study of Division I NCAA athletes, over a third of female athletes reported attitudes and symptoms, placing them at high risk for anorexia. And the same thing is true. It's not that high, but it also exists for male athletes, particularly in running and wrestling. So I'm really interested to know how college campuses, what I'm looking at now is how college campuses are addressing student athlete education, as well as screening for potential eating disorders. And Matt Lazier at Cal Poly did tell me that the sports medicine staff is in the process right now of implementing a mental health questionnaire for all the teams, and that includes a component on disordered eating. And I believe that sports medicine staff talks with them about eating and disordered eating as an aspect of overall health, maybe at the beginning of the year. You know, I'm interested to see if this comes to fruition and if there is an increase of student education, because right now, you know, just from what I've learned from talking to Hannah and from Libby about other students, is there's not a lot of awareness.
Yeah, I want to follow up on that with a little more statistics as well. So my master's thesis was on prevalence and prevention of eating disorders among college females. And there's not a lot of data out there on males, which is why it wasn't a little more comprehensive than that. But the studies were showing from Healthy Minds and some other studies that beyond the diagnosable eating disorder statistics that Monica was talking about of the, you know, 6 and 10%, about 50% of college females will exhibit disordered eating. So that means that they're not clinically diagnosable, but they are, you know, it's something that definitely could turn into a full-blown eating disorder, and it's definitely affecting their quality of life and probably their health. So it doesn't have to be this like super intense clinical diagnosis, need to be in a treatment center, you know, eating disorder to impact your life negatively.
So this is Eating Disorder Awareness Week. This runs February 25th through the 3rd, and I'm glad that you mentioned bringing light to more about eating disorders. I think people mostly think of anorexia and bulimia, but
yes,
there's a whole other spectrum of eating disorders, and it also affects men as well.
Yes. And we're also seeing, you know, higher prevalence rates in the LGBTQ plus community. So anytime, again, that we're using it as a coping mechanism, it's a really big thing. And males are less likely to seek help because it's stereotypical that it's a girl's disease or something. So, you know, most males are not talking about their feelings a lot. And eating disorders can look very different. There is something coined bigorexia, which is, you know, the trying to put on more muscle mass and be bigger. And it's, you know, or called reverse anorexia. There's a lot of different, you know, eating disorders that fit under a different heading, like chewing and spitting out food, diabetics who manipulate their insulin to try to manipulate their weight. There is a whole host of behaviors that are not normal and are not good for the body or the mind.
I just want to talk about why awareness seems to be so important for a moment. It is a really hidden and secretive problem. And just as anecdotal evidence, we found that when Hannah spoke out about her story and her experience, she had, you know, friends and other people that came to her and said that I'm experiencing this too, and she was able to direct them to help. In addition to that, you know, this was maybe one of the most impactful phone calls that I've ever gotten about a story that I've published, but I had an elderly man who lives in the county who is 82 years old and called me and told me that he's been struggling with binge eating his entire life, and he finally wanted to get help after reading the story. And I directed him to Libby, and that was just amazing to me. And I think it's an example of when people start to hear it being talked about and explain what it is, that does lead to improved health outcomes.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Hannah, talk to us about your journey coming forward and your life since the story's been published, and you've probably been talking to a lot of people about this. How
yes.
are you feeling?
I've been shocked at the amount of positive feedback that's come out of this story, and even just positivity in general about people that have read it or have gone through it. For some reason, I was thinking that people would have more of a negative opinion, that they would think I was disgusting for sharing it, or I shouldn't have shared that much because it was too personal. And I really think it's been amazing since the story's come out, honestly. I know a couple of my friends, you know, that have come up to me after the story, after reading it. They've said, hey, can I grab coffee with you? And then told me about the fact that they're starting to go to therapy for the first time, which is amazing. And I see them kind of starting to address something that they kind of thought it was maybe there before but didn't actually address for a while. And I see them getting help, which is so amazing. And, you know, a lot of my professors have come up to me and said, hey, I'm really proud of you for doing this. And, you know, I read your article in the Tribune, and, you know, I think it's really brave that you came forward. I've had other people say, wow, you're cured. That's great. And, you know, I was just like, well, that I wouldn't say cured. You know, I think eating disorders and recovery in general for mental health is an ongoing process, right? But I think overall the positivity from it has been really, really cool to see. And it kind of, as I've talked about it more, it's gotten easier to talk about it and kind of start conversations about it, which is so important. People just need to know that what they're feeling is normal. Those are completely normal thoughts to have, especially when you're going through really big transition periods in your life, like coming to college, and also especially in the athletic community, to be focused on your weight and wanting to get faster. It's really important for people to know that they're not alone, and I hope that's what the story helped accomplish.
We also talked about feeling worthy earlier. Do you feel worthy now, or are you getting there?
I definitely feel way more worthy than I felt in the middle of this eating disorder, or really even half a year ago, you know, when this, you know, we were starting to think about what this article would look like. And I would say even telling the story to Monica for the first time in kind of a setting that I knew would be more public, that was really, really difficult. And I was ashamed. I had emailed her a couple times saying, I don't know if I want to share that. And she had encouraged me and said, no, I really think people will relate to it more if you're real about your struggle. And I think you sharing these personal experiences really will allow people to connect more with, you know, what they're struggling with what you're struggling with. And I think it just helps lessen the stigma around mental health in general, anxiety and depression and eating disorders. There's so many students, especially in Cal Poly, but more so people in the SLO County that struggle with mental health. And a lot of the time it's easy to get into a cycle of thinking where you're feeling like, wow, I'm the weird one. No one else is struggling with this because it hasn't been talked about. And that's just not the truth at all. I think everybody experiences thoughts like that, and they need to know that.
Before we go today, I just wanted to open up the floor to everybody. What more can colleges do to assist with eating disorders?
There's actually a lot colleges can be doing. And just from the little research I've done, there's not a lot of colleges that are doing a whole lot about eating disorders in general, not in a great sense other than having, you know, general counselors on campus. None of the three colleges in our area are really super focused on eating disorders, and none of them currently have a dietitian on campus working with their health center. That's an integral part of the treatment team for eating disorders. I mean, we've already shown that statistics among colleges are very high for eating disorder population, and really colleges should be having trained professionals in this area. You know, whether it's a therapist, a dietitian, a medical provider, typically they're not getting a lot of eating disorder education just straight out of school. If you want to specialize in this field, you need to go above and beyond doing continuing education, finding mentors, really getting that experience. So getting specialists on site on the schools is really what needs to be done, because this is a huge population. So yeah, we need to have trained professionals on site. We need to have communication amongst the professionals. So being able to have the doctor and the therapist talking to each other, that's something that is just not done in a lot of college settings, which is so weird. And that's just something to do with the legalities of it. If you went to any treatment center, they would be talking all the time.
Well, Hannah, thank you so much for coming in and speaking with us. Congratulations on your journey. And
thank you. Of course.
Good luck as you move forward. And Monica, we have more to look forward to from you. I'm sure you'll be keeping an eye on this from Cal Poly.
I will.
If anyone wants to read your story, it's up on the Tribune website. That's sanluisobispo.com.
That's right.
Monica Vaughn, Hannah Allen, and Libby Parker, thank you so much for coming in and speaking with us today.
Thank you, Tyler.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
You're tuned to KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio.